Welcome to Avashin Podcast. In this podcast, we welcome guests who are waging a struggle. My name is Frederike Geerdink. I'm a journalist who writes and speaks about power structures and those who want to tear them down. This podcast is powered by Media News, which you can visit at medianews.net. Let me explain why this podcast is called Avashin, meaning blue water. Avashin is a region in the mountains of Kurdistan, where the river by the same name has its source. The Avashin is clear, blue, and sparkling, and an inspiration in the Kurdish struggle for freedom. In this episode, I'm honored to welcome Lina Zedriga as my guest. Lina Zedriga lives in Kampala, Uganda. She's a former judge, she's a lawyer and an activist, and has been fighting for human rights and women's rights in Uganda for many years. She's been active in the People Power movement and became the second person in the grassroots political party National Unity Platform, which is challenging the rule of longtime president and dictator Museveni. Leader of that movement is Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, known by his stage name Bobby Wine. Welcome as my guest, Lina. My first question to you would be, what is the source of your struggle? Where did it all begin for you?
Thank you so much, Frederick, for taking your time and looking out to some of our the people like us in Uganda. I actually live more in northern Uganda. I was born in West Nile, which borders southern Sudan and eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, in Arua. I grew up in the village. And a typical village at my time, I was born in 1961. Cultural dictates, very patriarchal society, where that girls were not supposed to go to school. Where did my struggle start? At birth. It started at birth. We were born three of us, two boys and one girl. Unfortunately, the two have both died. I was the last born. And at that time, somehow I was a welcome child. So as I grew, the elder brothers, David and Joseph, may their souls rest in peace, would be allowed to go and play. As for me, I was being, coerced or socialized into going to fetch firewood, going to fetch water, very long distance. And my time, girls were being socialized just for marriage. However, my mother, though she didn't go to school, may her soul rest in peace. She's called Magdalene. She passed on just 3 years ago, a vernacular teacher, and then upgraded. So I went to school early because of that. It was a privilege for me. And we were quite a number of girls in primary one. But by the time I reached primary five, we were only three girls in the class. The rest had dropped up and gone to get married very, very early. And by the time I reached P7, I was the only girl. So it dawned on me that low turning point. I was studying for the 50 plus girls, my colleagues who had dropped out of school from primary one to primary seven. I was blessed because I passed so well. My determination was beyond compare. And so I passed very well. I went now from West Nile to a missionary school. We are practicing Catholics, to a girls only school, Sacred Heart Girls School. And that was a very great school. So from West Nile, we had to travel the whole day. I saw electricity for the first time in January when I went to secondary school, high school. I saw running water for the first time when I went to secondary school. So everything for me was a struggle. And to that extent, even wearing my night dress for the first time and having my own bed for the first time. So the struggle just was from birth. It made me so determined. And the sisters loved me. The school was run by the Catholic nuns.
Did you already know at the time that you wanted to be a lawyer or that you wanted to be in activism, politics? Like, when did that dawn on that girl at the time?
Okay, the activism dawned on me actually when I was a refugee in 1980. 1979-80, I was a refugee in DR Congo. That was the time Idi Amin was overthrown by Obote and we were in a refugee setting. The discrimination and the plight of the refugees. Then I knew I wanted actually to be first a doctor, a medical doctor. And then it dawned on me I needed to be a lawyer. So that's when I, then 1980, I couldn't make it because of the displacement 2 years. And by the time I came to sit my O-level, A-level, the advanced levels for university, I didn't perform well. So I went to be an educationist. I trained as a teacher. And I taught. Then I got married. And by the pressure on me was so much. Your peers have already gotten married. You are now wasted. You are throwing children away. And so our time, our generation, when you graduate, the man must be next. But I also joined to be a nun, a Catholic nun. And then also the challenges inside and the socialization. You know, there were things that kind of did not promote it well. Then I decided to leave and became, I continued and became a teacher, then got married. Then I have 5 children. I'm a mother of 5 children, 1 girl and 4 boys, biological, but I also I fostered a number of other children. So in my culture, whatever you have in the house belongs to the man and his clan. So that for me was something I needed to ensure that I was protected and my children were protected. So then it dawned on me after 1985, when 86, when Museveni came to power, I was in Arua with my daughter and one son, and in the village, the patriarchal issues of me not even having decisions over the goats which I had, the gardens that I had, the land that I was tilling, and was separated. My husband was actually cut off in Kampala, and I was in Arua, I was in the village. So for me, those were times when I said, this should not happen again. The bicycle, a bicycle which he left, my late brother-in-law took it, said it doesn't, you didn't come from, we married you with the cows, it didn't come from, I mean, you didn't come with any bicycle here, you know? So you don't own anything, you are also actually owned. And you know, simple things like even the sewing machine, which the family has, you don't have any property. So it dawned on me when I came to Kampala to join my husband along a very long route via the Democratic Republic of Congo. I decided to go and do law. I decided to go and study law to protect myself and my children. And of course, then when I became a lawyer, I also joined to be a judicial officer because of the plight. Those were my drives, the injustices in society. The pressure that women do not own anything. The pressure that women are actually property. Our time, I said, my daughter should not go through that and her generations and other women. So I specialized more in the family and children's courts in terms of maintenance and, you know, so in the family, I piloted the family and children's court. They call it the FCC. Where specifically
you initiated the setting up of that court.
Yes, yes. Now it was also rolled out. It was rolled out. Then I saw the plight of women is more than just judging, or it was about knowledge, it was about power, it's about a voice. So I saw that in civil society. Then I became very active, and the opportunity came in 2001 when there was the Lord's Resistance Army, Joseph Kony war up northern Uganda with the UPDF. And I was,
can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yes. In the whole of northern Uganda, especially actually sub-region Lango, sub-region Teso, sub-region and West Nile, there was a war over 25 years. It was actually, the rebellion was first started by a woman called Alice Lakwena. When she went into exile in Kenya, and eventually now she died, her brother called Joseph Kony, a very notorious Lord's Resistance Army leader, brutal. They would cut off people's lips. They were waging war against the UPDF in the whole of northern Uganda. So people were displaced in what notoriously came to be known as the internal displacement people's camps. Horrific situation. Horrific. Horrific. And women's breasts were being cut when they would end up in ambush, the lips cut. Rape being used as a weapon of war. For me, it was very horrific. Another turning point was when I was contracted by an organization called ACCORD, Agents for Cooperation and Research and Development. And we went to do a sensitization in one of the notorious camps in Pabo. As we were looking at UN Security Council Resolution 1325, the power of women, how you can organize in it, I saw a group of women under a tree. It was around 3 o'clock, seated together. There were over 30, 40. Then after the sensitization, public sensitization, I saw these women. And then I asked people, why are these women not here? This conversation is actually for them. People laughed. I said, why are you people laughing? Then they say, they are seeing the moon. You know, culturally, when I'm having my period, nobody's supposed to know about it. Nobody's supposed, it is an abomination. So women innovatively, because they didn't have pads, there was no water, they innovatively got some dry sand and soil, and then would gather every morning and even in the night under that tree and sit and drain the blood. The most horrific scene that has lived with me up to today, that a reproductive health right became an issue of incarceration of women.
Many different problems that you're talking about.
Yes.
And as an activist, you want to be involved in making things better on all these different fields. How do you connect them? How do you make them into one struggle? What is your basic view behind connecting them?
For me, they actually build me and moved from one struggle to another, because we ended up mobilizing an advocacy thing around women's reproductive health and provision of reusable pads. Two, we also mobilized women around UN Security Council Resolution 1325 to end the war that was making women conditions of reproductive health or having their periods very inhuman. That's why we were able to move to Juba with the Women's Peace Torch. The women of Uganda moved, and the women from the region moved. And we had our protocol to the Juba Peace Protocol based on all these experiences. So then I saw that it was very important that politics, the political will has to be there if women's meaningful participation has to be realized. And that's why in 2016, I joined to run for a member of parliament. And when I believe very strongly that I was rigged out, I decided to lie low. But now I joined, I was identified by Bobi Wine. His Excellency Robert Kyagulanyi, Bobi Wine identified me when I knew I was deciding to retire and go back to socialize, to mentor girls from primary schools, because I'm 60 now. I felt my time was to go and train and inspire girls as they grow up and they will see me.
Yeah, because that's what I also saw, that you were almost ready to retire, but then were drawn into politics again by Bobi Wine. Can you explain who Bobi Wine is and why you decided to stand by him and to together? Because it's the people power movement, but his political party is called the NUP, the National Unity Platform, right?
Yes.
Can you explain who Bobi Wine is?
Yes, absolutely. Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, aka Bobi Wine, is a musician, but his music is always it's about the plight of the people, about human rights, about the struggle and so on. He came to light first because of those very, very inspirational music, and which spoke. He comes from a ghetto background, but is a self-made person. So he won a by-election in 2018. As he was in parliament, he continued to inspire young people. And then when the 2021 elections came, he offered himself as a presidential candidate and registered a party called the National Unity Platform Party. But before that, as he was running for the by-election in 2018, his slogan, it was people power, our power, people power, our power. So it was robust, it was inspirational, it was speaking to everybody. Young people came on board and, you know, we are going to fix all these wrongs that are happening. Judiciary is, you know, the situation is so bad, by the way, really bad. So then when I stood in 2016 under the Democratic Party, Nup wasn't there. Then I decided I was not going to have politics, I was going to inspire people. Then 2021, he decided to run, I mean, for the 2021 elections as a presidential candidate. Just before that, among other horrific things that the dictatorship in Uganda has done, was to slam a very, very high cost on social media tax. Social media tax. So they protested. And among others was a young girl whom I mentored under Forum for Women Democracy called Rita. As Rita was dressed up in the beret and, you know, a color, the red, and she was knocked down maliciously, deliberately by a police vehicle. And that police vehicle, by the way, is bought by money from the Netherlands and EU and stuff, you know, and that's what it did. So it, for me, was a game changer. We, Uganda, women under the People Power Movement, and we did, we condemned it in a press conference that we held as women of Uganda. And when Robert, His Excellency, the elected president, who was not announced, who was robbed of his victory, had that clip, it went, I will try to look for it, where I said, enough is enough. We cannot be hiding in our closets when this, Rita was only 22 years old. And so many other people had disappeared. So then he asked me to be his coordinator for Northern Uganda, because the previous person had been bought off, because that's what the government does, buys people, bought off. Then he was called Boss Mikotim. It was as if now in the North there would be no people power. And this was February. March, when he asked me, I said yes. There was the lockdown of COVID. I could not be announced immediately. So on the 8th of April, I was unveiled. And my first task was to take some foodstuffs in solidarity to the National Task Force. And it went sensational. It went sensational. And so then after that, with the time when we registered in NUP, the National Unity Platform Party, in October 2020, and we ran the election, the campaigns and the presidential and parliamentary elections just 2-3 months old, but we believe very strongly we won overwhelmingly. When you see the crowds in the whole of Uganda, the defiance of the people, the young people who came to run for political and elective positions, it was a transformational thing.
How many years have you been an activist now?
As an activist, I think all my life.
I'm always wondering, with people who are waging a struggle for so long, for several decades, what they have learned along the way about waging a struggle, and if their goal has changed or adapted. Can you say something about it? What you've learned in all these years about struggling?
You see, it is a life. It is not an event where you think you are traveling and you are arriving. You just know you will travel. You travel with the baton. It is a long relay. You hand it over to the next generation. Because if you start having a break, then it means you are not focused. It means you are not focused. You are losing your identity. Because for me, and I know the many who have been there in the struggle for a long time, even Belarus, where globally, Ambassador Swanee Hunt, and it is a journey. It's your life. You immerse yourself in it.
And that is one of the things that you learned. In the beginning, you were maybe not aware of that yet when you were in your 20s.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. In the beginning, I thought it starts here and ends here. No, you do not end it actually. You hand it over. The pattern over. That's why then I immersed myself in mentorship of young men and young women who are alternative and transformative leaders, creating that pool of practitioners who will be able to light others at whatever levels. Yes.
And is that what the People's Power Movement is about also for you?
To pass on
what you've learned?
Yes. And absolutely. Yeah. The People's
Power Movement. Because it's a young movement.
Yes, it really is. 2018. It really is, but it for the People Power Movement, under the leadership of His Excellency Robert Kyagulanyi, Bobi Wine, Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, aka Bobi Wine, he was the face of it. These movements have actually been there for quite some time, but then he came and people identified with it. The majority of Ugandans are very poor. The majority of Ugandans cannot speak. They are so afraid, but they are so for that. So that social injustice, economic injustice, corruption, when he spoke about it and he's offering himself, he's beaten. In fact, during the campaigns, he was targeted to have been killed, It is a campaign when you watch, he had to be, availed with the protective headgear, protective bulletproof headgear and a bulletproof vest. Where do you in the world, in a civil participation issue, election campaigns, find it so militarized, tear gas. Everywhere we were going, I was arrested on a campaign trail on the 11th of November by anti-terrorist groups, over 50 of them, and we were only 5 in the vehicle, abducted, thrown on the back of the pickup, beaten and driven at high speed, and then dumped in a police cell. But when the police post immediately was surrounded by a whole barracks of military and imprisoned with men. I have the clips with men. Where do you find that? And then many of our campaign team members, up to today, they're actually in jail, being tried in military court martial. Many have been abducted. Many have been murdered, killed. We are documenting them. Many were thrown in the River Nile. They tied stones on their legs and threw them in Obongi. Many just beaten to death in blatant impunity. I've never seen it before. 60 years. I've seen it here in Uganda. I've witnessed it. It's like I wake up, okay, I hope this was a dream. It was not. Okay? It wasn't. Everywhere we went, tear gas, live bullets, and murdering, running over people with the military vehicle, running over supporters who are wearing red, deliberately to kill them, and they were killed. It's horrible.
Doesn't it? It must be scary for you too. Does it ever make you consider to stop?
No, it actually inspires me more. It inspires me a lot because you see, like today I was in court, this started two young men and one girl, Olivia. They were abducted on a campaign trail. They have been charged of possessing one bullet, but it's all trumped up and being tried in a military court martial. And they are still so resilient. They come out, they say people power. They are in the most horrific prisons. Very bad situations. The brutality around it is just too much. And they're very innocent people. When you visit, when you encounter those, it makes me stronger that we will change it. We will reclaim our stolen victory. We will do it and create a better, safe Uganda.
Because you think that last year Museveni won the elections again, but you think it was stolen, there were irregularities, it was not a fair election?
I'm not thinking. We have evidence. I am not thinking, yeah. Frederick. Yeah. I am not thinking Museveni's popularity is not there.
How is he going to be really removed from power? Because you have evidence. The elections were not fair. He stole the elections. What can you do? How can you struggle to end his time?
So one of the things we have looked at, what is sustaining him in all this impunity, is foreign aid, because all his budget is funded by donors, US, EU, and so on. So we have identified them, and we have also seen where this money of the taxpayers from your country and Europe is going. My president was there speaking to the EU Parliament and telling them, you are funding terror, you are funding all the gross human rights abuses. And you saw the case of Kakwenza, and he had to, just because of a tweet. That is how it, and he's just the face of the very many. And one, two, we are documenting all this and also saying, please, Ugandans need the global solidarity. Three, we have communities that are organizing themselves to voice out, to speak, to refuse to be bought. You know, for a long time, what happened was Museveni would buy people, the most outspoken. I was offered 5 billion Uganda shillings. It was even to go to it in dollars, $2 million. I refused. So
very good.
Now, and very many people refused. Yeah, many. The offers are going on even right now. Some of the local council leaders are being offered abnormal kinds of money. But when you look at women, the health facilities in Mulai, it's horrific. How would I even think about what are they buying? Then you look at the sale, blatant modern day slavery in the Middle East of Ugandans, organs, human beings. How do you start doing that?
The People's Power Movement also attracts a lot of young people. What is the main thing that you teach the young people in the movement? But probably like the women who are connected to it in their 20s, you are probably a big role model for them. What do you teach them? They look up to you, they take words from you. What do you teach them?
Actually, thank you so much, Frederick. There's nothing I'm teaching them. There's a lot they're teaching me. Because by the time I joined the People Power Movement, all the young people were already in that space. They were occupying that space, demanding, to be heard, demanding to be the leaders, demanding. They were already there. Me, when I came on board, I only added something very little in terms of the experience, in terms of the Northern Uganda, in terms of coming from a civil society background and so on. We are non-violent. These are people whose realities the president speaks to. Okay? So they are, and it is the majority of Ugandans. And because of the exclusion, because of the violations of human rights, because of the nepotism, because of all the bad things, bad governance, and the unemployment rate is just abnormal. So people felt enough is enough. The young people think now it's their time to create this space and take charge of reorganizing Uganda. So mine is just to say, yes, you can do it, we can do it. And they also inspire me a lot. They really do. This time the struggle is led and has the face of young people.
Beautiful. What does give you hope? Because these are big powers that you are struggling against. What gives you hope that eventually you will win?
It has happened before, and it will always, history repeats itself. What gives me hope? The people, the population of Uganda is with the struggle, for the struggle. What time is on our side? Everybody is so fed up with all these lies and whatever. People just want that change. People want their humanity restored. The degeneration is, that is what gives me hope. One, what gives me hope is the fact that our leader is a very inspirational person. Much as he would have stayed in his comfort zone, he has a nice house, a beautiful wife. He crossed his comfort zone to inspire Ugandans and pitch a genuine leadership. That's what inspires us. What inspires us, sometimes when we are arrested, the police and the military say, we are actually with you. Yeah? We are actually with you, but for us, what we are doing here is a duty. And we know one of the, I know one of the policemen who protected the, His Excellency Bobby Wine in Karamoja, when he was supposed to have been shot, this policeman came and protected him and also shot back. He was the bodyguard. He actually lost a leg or something to that. And me, that time I was imprisoned. I was in a military detention, you know, military detention, and brought to court the next day under trumped up charges. And in fact, when I was being arrested, that what is very important, what inspired me, in the bush, in a very lonely, you know, place there, the whole village, women with children on their backs came. They were shouting, why are you arresting our fear people's power? And then I asked them, why are you arresting me? They said, keep quiet, we're arresting you because we want to keep you alive. We are supposed to have shot you on sight. That was the order. And that order, the man told me they were to shoot me on sight on the 11th of November, but they did not shoot me on sight. They were to have abducted me that night when they camped a whole military barracks, but they failed to abduct me. Why? Because of the international, you know, and the constituencies, the women lawyers, the women's movement, His Excellencies from, because I'm the Secretary of Africa Working Group on Global Action Against Mass Atrocities, and I'm in so many, you know, the lawyers and so on. So it became so hard for them to kill me. It became impossible. So that also gives me hope that there's a global voice and constituency. What gives me hope? There is our diaspora team that is running an online training and civic education program. The Uganda is bleeding. You should be there to watch. We have international partners who are pitching us in terms of non-violence movements. So what keeps me going is the fact that the wave of change and the need for the change for Uganda is here.
You don't sound like a woman who is on the short term again considering to retire.
Frederick, you never know. Maybe not. Yeah, but right now what I know is I'm in the race and I'm in the right space to do it. But whether I will retire or whether I will not, let the current events determine. Inspire me is the icon, Nelson Mandela. Time comes, yes. When you have created enough team, you now retire. I definitely, once the right team is there, there's no reason for me to be standing here. I will now have to go take a back seat and do an advisory role. I would love that because now I want also to enjoy my grandchildren. I have 5 grandchildren. I want to have time for them, which I did not give to my own children. Yes, I think when the right time comes, it will be like delivering. That will just have to come naturally. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you very much. I'm going to say Serkeftin. That is the Kurdish way to say, may you be successful.
Serkeftin.
You have
How
been
do I respond
to...
in it?
Oh, you can also say Serkeftin. You can also say Serkeftin. Yes.
Serkeftin. Thank you.
You've been listening to Avashin Podcast, powered by Media News. Your host was Frederike Geerding. The music you heard was composed and performed by Ula Sheshil. I would highly appreciate it if you shared this podcast on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or wherever you are online. Thank you in advance and until the next episode of Avashin Podcast. Thank you very much again, Lina Zedrika.
Thank you, Frederick.